As we begin tonight, we're going to be in 1 Kings, the 4th chapter, and we are about to start into the temple, and I want to encourage you, as you study the lessons on the temple, don't let yourself be overwhelmed by all the numbers and all the measurements, and, you know, there are a lot of numbers, there's going to be a lot of distances, heights, weights, you know, various things, but drink in the grandeur of this building and the attention to detail and the various things, but don't let it overwhelm you. Sometimes we can get just kind of lost in all that minutia, but great, great story. But tonight, we're going to finish up the 4th chapter, and I want us to think back for a moment to the time of Abraham. You know, when you're going through the Bible, it's striking sometimes how much emphasis is given to certain characters. You look at the book of Genesis. The first 11 chapters cover several thousand years. Then you get to Abraham at the end of chapter 11. He's introduced there in the last few verses of chapter 11. And it really slows down. I mean, Abraham is a man when he's introduced to us. He'll live to be 175. Well, his death is not told to us to chapter 25. I mean, you think about how in 11 chapters we cover thousands of years. You know, then we're going to take 14 or so chapters just to deal with that 100 year or so period of Abraham's life. Great emphasis given to him. But we talked about, beginning in chapter 12, that God called Abraham and said he was going to make out of him a what? A great nation. And he was going to give that nation what? The land of Canaan. And of course, the ultimate promise is that through his seed, what would happen? All the nations of the earth would be blessed. Where in the New Testament do we read that that seed that he was speaking of was Christ? Galatians 3:16. The spiritual promise is somewhat in the background here. But think about these two parts of the promise. When we are reading about Solomon here in chapter 4, it talks about how he had dominion from Egypt up to the Euphrates. They've been given the land. And one of the things that chapter 4 just brings out is indeed, this is a great nation now. This is a powerful people that God has given them just exactly what he said he would do. He's fulfilled these promises. It's a time of peace and security. We were talking at the very end Sunday morning how in verse 24 he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river from Tipsa even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river. He had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Now, you've got this same map in your material, somewhere around page 2. I want you to take note, this is the region from here, the yellow, even up through the dotted line, is under the dominion of Solomon. But the two arrows kind of bracket where the Israelites actually lived. Dan to the north, Beersheba to the south. And he says, look at the picture here. Again, they dwelt safely under the vine and the fig tree. They're enjoying the harvest of the land. They're enjoying it with peace and security. You know, things are just really good. And then he talks about the court. Now, what we have described in 22 and 23 is probably not what you would have had from day one. But this is where it came to be. And look at this picture. Now, Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. Now, there are several things in this that we want to see. First of all, what a great nation this is. I mean, here at the palace each day, they're consuming all this food. Now, I don't know about you, but even when I've been to Sam's Club in the big quantity, I've never gone in and says, give me a core of flour. You know, we tend to buy ours in different measures. But according to the margin, it says that a core equaled 5 bushels. Now, the English Standard Bible that I looked at, it gave about 6 bushels. Well, a bushel's a lot. This is the amount, excuse me, each day, 150 bushels of the fine wheat flour. The meal is probably still wheat, but just not ground as finely. They didn't have cornmeal like we did. What you think about all the money Solomon had, and he couldn't enjoy cornbread baked in a cast iron skillet. I mean, see, money can't buy everything. But look at this amount. This would be the approximate gallons. If you want to break it out into pounds, you're welcome to. That's a lot of flour every day. And then you look at the animals. Each day, 10 fatted oxen. They're also bringing 20 out of the pastures. And 100 sheep a day. We're talking about feeding thousands of people every day. Well, where is this food coming from? The taxpayers, the people. Remember the 12 governors. This is one of those, I think this chapter, it has two purposes. Oh, it illustrates they've become a great nation. But it's setting us up for when we get to chapter 12 and the people said, hey, this is after Solomon's died, they go to Rehoboam. Your dad was really too hard on us. It was costly. You're going to have to lighten the burden. The people, they're living peacefully from Dan to Beersheba, but increasingly a lot of their wealth, their prosperity has to go to the king's court. They're having to help him with that. In the time of Nehemiah, which comes after the captivity, Nehemiah is going to be 600 or so years later. Nehemiah talks about his provisions. He doesn't give as much detail, but he said, daily at my table, we had 1 ox and 6 sheep along with some fowl. Look at it. 1 ox, 6 sheep, not 100 sheep a day, not 30 oxen total a day. We had 1 and 6 sheep. I just want you to, next time you come to Nehemiah and you're reading about this little remnant that's come back and you're trying to, you think back, oh yeah, let me go back to 1 Kings 4 because you probably won't remember the exact numbers. And you go back and you compare and you will better appreciate why Zechariah and Haggai would have to say to that remnant, yes, you can do this. What comes back out of captivity is not this great prosperous nation like you have right now. Look at verse 26 through 28. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And these governors, each man in his month, provided food for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table. There was no lack in their supply. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. I would suggest to you 3 things that are being said here. Again, it's just emphasizing the grandeur. This is a great and powerful nation. God had said to Solomon, I'll make you great, make you famous. He is. But he's also, without coming right out and saying it, he's giving us a hint that Solomon's going down the wrong path. Go back to Deuteronomy 17. Daryl looked at some of the things from Deuteronomy 17 one Wednesday night not long ago. Deuteronomy 17, in verse 16, well, let me pick up at verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. He said, don't set a foreigner over you. Then verse 16, but he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. When you make yourself a king, he's not to be multiplying horses. What were horses used for in those days? War. They were war animals. They were sometimes used for riding fast for messengers. You know, they would use, but they were not primarily transportation. You know, in that country, in the mountainous area, you either walked or you might ride a donkey or a mule, but horses weren't in Palestine used for transportation. They were war animals. But he says, I don't want you involved with Egypt. Well, what's he doing? He's multiplying horses. He's got, I would say, 2 Chronicles 9, instead of 40,000 stalls, says 4,000. And later in the ninth chapter, chapter 10, verse 26, he says there were like 1,400 chariots. So, but you've got 4,000 stalls. You've got 12,000 mounted cavalry. You know, he's going against it. But also notice this. The governors, they're not only having to provide for King Solomon and those at his table an awful lot of food, they're having to bring barley and straw to the proper place. When you've got more than 13,000, the chariot was typically pulled by two horses, according to the monuments that are available from then, so 2028, you've got close to 15,000 horses. You think they'd go through a lot of straw in a day? A lot of work? The tax burden. Now, he doesn't say really much about it, but he's laying groundwork. This is one of those things, if we've paid attention in Deuteronomy and we get here, we ought to be going, wait a minute. Something not quite like what right. 1 Samuel 8, when the people wanted a king, God said, okay, Samuel, give them a king, but tell them this is what it'll be like. It's starting to be like that. You didn't see it so much under Saul and David, at least explained, but now it's going to be an issue. So, it's kind of thing, just file away. It's going to come back. Brother Hutchison. I think you're right. There's a lack of faith there. What did we see at the beginning about his marriage? Who did he marry? He married the Pharaoh's daughter. You know, he makes an alliance with him. It's not, at this point, Solomon has not turned his back on God and become an idolater like he will later on. But there are weaknesses in his faith that are already evident. Trusting in war horses, trusting in his alliance with the Pharaoh. There's a weakness. Anybody else thought or comment before we look at the last part of the chapter? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It'll go far. That's so true. So true. All right, let's look at 29 through 34. I want to say a little bit about his wisdom and maybe some of his writings here, if we have time. And God gave Solomon wisdom, an exceedingly great understanding, and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Here is Solomon becoming famous. Chapter 10, the Queen of Sheba will visit. Now, when Solomon asked for wisdom, why did he ask for the wisdom? What was his purpose, he said, in seeking wisdom? He didn't know how to do it. He was young. He wanted to be able to judge the people. It was to be a servant to the people. It was a very noble request. And God was pleased with that request. And he gets that wisdom. He has a wisdom and intelligence and understanding that is just with the men of the east that were known for wisdom, greater than them. Egypt is known for, it was a great learning center. He's got more than they. And word just begins to spread. Well, every bit of that could have been a good thing. That fame could have been used to point people toward the Lord God. But what we're going to see as we go along with the life of Solomon is Solomon himself is drifting from God. And, you know, it's not going to be that way. But, you know, he was wiser than Ethan. And I don't know if that's He-Man, you know, like a really strong guy, or Heman. Chalcol and Darda, sons of Mahal. We don't know much about any of those. But evidently, in the days of Solomon, those guys were well known. Solomon beat them all. He was smart. And he spoke, how many proverbs? 3,000. How many proverbs are found in the book of Proverbs? I don't know that. That's a question, you never ask a question you don't know the answer to, but I don't. What I do know is there are 915 verses in the book of Proverbs. And sometimes more than one verse is involved in a proverb. So what that means is we've got way less than, we got less than a third of his proverbs preserved for us. Why don't we have all of Solomon's proverbs? Yeah, some of the proverbs just weren't worthy of preservation in Scripture, obviously. In verse 33, he spoke of trees, the cedar, the hyssop that springs out of the wall, animals, birds, creeping. His reflections on birds and fish, they may have been very interesting to people, but they're not what we need for eternal life. And so they weren't preserved. What about his songs? 1,005. Now, even though we don't have nearly all of his proverbs, we do have a lot of proverbs from Solomon. But when it comes to his songs, Psalm 72 is attributed to Solomon. Psalm 127. And then, of course, you've got the Song of Solomon. That's it. Now, David, his father, a lot of psalms are given to him. So, evidently his songs, maybe they were not generally of a spiritual nature. Maybe they were about birds and creeping things. I don't know. But they reflected his wisdom. And that brings up something. On page four of the material I gave you, I've got a Old Testament chronology chart. And I know it's kind of small, but if your arms are long enough, you can read it. That's the way I view it. You know, the print's never too small if I can hold it out this far and still see it. The wisdom literature all was largely written or compiled during the reigns of David and Solomon. Or it would appear that way. You might notice over here, I've got something about Job. Job would appear to have lived around the time of Abraham. But the vocabulary, the style of the Hebrew, some other things point to a much later date for the writing. The time of Solomon, possibly the time of Hezekiah. But biggest part of the Psalms, or a big part of them, written by David. Most of the Proverbs by Solomon, though some of them are collected by Hezekiah. Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. It's interesting that during this 80-year period, we have the rise of this style of literature. You know, we've had books being written from the time of Moses for 500 years. Brother Waldron, in his book, Give Us a King, suggests that the wisdom literature begins to appear, that is Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, because it is a time of peace and reflection. Though David fought some wars, David brought, you know, he conquered and he eliminated many of the threats. And the time of Solomon was a time to reflect on life and the meaning of life. If that's not why, you know, I mean, there's also the fact that Solomon had all this wisdom that nobody else had. But it was a time for this kind of writing. And we don't have time to go into it all, but I want to take a few moments. I just want to talk about Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon before we go into the temple on Sunday. How many chapters in Proverbs? 31. I ask that question because I want to encourage you. You don't have to do it right now. You do it. But from time to time, I would encourage you, commit yourself to 3 months with the Proverbs. Day one, start, you know, October 1st, you know, take this month. October 1st, read Proverbs 1. October 2nd, read, you know, Proverbs 2. And do that through November and December. Spend 3 months. In November, you only have 30 days, so you have to read 2 chapters on the 30th. That, it's easy to remember, isn't it? You know, let's see, this is the 16th, so I wonder what chapter I'm on. You know, you can remember that. And then, something I've done in some classes I've taught that has proven extremely helpful. As you read the chapters, do a journal. Make it easier and say a short paragraph each day. What I saw in Proverbs 1. And when you get to, like, if you start in October, which is too late to start in October, but, you know, the next month, when you're on day one, Proverbs 1, don't look at what you wrote the first month. Read your chapter, then do your journal for that day. After you've done it, then you can flip back and look at it. And you will be amazed sometimes, especially when you get over chapter 10 when it starts the short Proverbs. You'll be amazed sometimes what stood out to you 1 month will be different another month, because it has so much of that. But the book of Proverbs is just practical wisdom for living. It's advice on work, on family, on the tongue. Some of it is the kind of stuff you could have probably figured out for yourself. Like he says, it's better not to be a borrower. Well, when you're falling behind on payments, you realize that. But what it is, it's God giving us the wisdom so we don't have to make the mistakes. You know, experience is a great teacher. But usually, what does experience mean? usually that means we had a big mistake. You don't have to make the mistakes. If you have the fear of the Lord, you can learn these. But in the book of Proverbs, the first 9 chapters, they're not all your typical Proverbs, short sayings. There's some lengthy paragraphs. You get to chapter 10, and then it just becomes that kind of material that it's just a collection. And, you know, you can just turn to chapter 12 and start reading. And unlike 1 Kings, you won't be going, well, what's the context? It's just practical wisdom. But, you know, that's just something to do from time to time. And I really think you'll benefit from it. Proverbs is one of, you know, a lot of people's favorite books. It's so easy to read. Then Ecclesiastes comes along, and man, you talk about shifting gears, being a different style of book. Ecclesiastes can be tough. At times it almost seems to contradict itself. It doesn't, but you've got to work with it. The conclusion at the end of the book needs to guide you throughout the book. The conclusion, chapter 12, fear God and keep His commandments. This is man's all. God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. That's the conclusion. But I think sometimes people get the idea, well, then what Ecclesiastes is about is like saying, look, life stinks. Life's unfair. Life is hard. But if you can somehow make it to the judgment, then it'll all be good. Yeah? No, it's not. That's not what the book is saying, you know. But the book does challenge us to see the realities of life for what they are. That we have a tendency to think, if I can just be famous, if I can just be rich, if I can just have this, if I can have that, then I will be happy. And he says things like, okay, look, you get all this wealth, you know what you're going to end up doing? You're going to be worried about what's the stock market doing? You know, who's going to break in and steal my wealth? You know, what are my children going to do with the inheritance? They're probably going to squander this. I've worked all these years for this, all this money. I'm going to leave it to my kids. They're going to waste it. You know, you're going to worry about things like that. You know, he says, you know, you're going to be famous. And he said, I'll tell you something. Once you're gone, people are going to forget about you. People are not going to remember you. And we want to make a name for ourselves. How many times you've been driving down the road and you come along to some bridge and it'll say the Sergeant, you know, Joe Smith Memorial Bridge. You go, who's Sergeant Joe Smith, you know? I mean, you drive down Nick Davis Road. It's named after Nicholas Davis. You know, what do you know about Nicholas Davis? I mean, who knows? I mean, these people are forgotten. Brother Hutchison. If you want to read about it, you can, but how many people do? I did one time, but, and that's what he's telling us, these kinds of things. And then, I like chapter 10. He says that, chapter 9 rather. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. I train and I'm the fastest. And what happens out there? I pull a hammy and I can't finish the race and the old slowpoke beats me. But then what he turns around, he says, look, if you can accept the fact that the ultimate is the reward in heaven, and you can accept the fact that death is a certainty, it's going to happen to everybody, that nothing will stave that off. He said, what you'll find out is you can embrace life. Once you realize this life is not what it's all about, then you actually can enjoy life. Chapter 3, for example. Verse 12. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. This is right after he's told us, yeah, there's a time, we're going to be born, we're going to die. There'll be times of war and there'll be times of peace. There'll be all, life's just filled with all kinds of things. But he said, just when a moment is good, enjoy that moment. I get so worried about, you know, life, I've got to have everything perfect. He said, no. Did you see that beautiful sunset? Enjoy that. Enjoy that. Rejoice with the wife of your youth. He talks about there is betrayal in this life. There are people who will let you down. But he said, I'll tell you something, two are still better than one. You know, they have a good reward for their labor. You know, you may be overpowered by another. Two can withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. One of the things that this book is about is, he said, you know, happiness is not found in these relationships. Because sometimes they fail you. Then he turns around and says, but don't give up on relationships. Don't give up on people. I've come to really appreciate Ecclesiastes because it speaks to me. It really speaks. You know, that there are times that, you know, I get caught up in, I will be happy if I have these things. No. And then I turn around, and when I realize that ain't going to get it, and I see the bad side of life, I get really discouraged, and I start, that's all I can see. And Solomon says, no. He said, you need to see these realities, and you need to appreciate them. But then grab hold of when the good times come. You know, you may not, you know, all of life is not going to be good. Every day won't be a great day. But there will be good days, and enjoy those good days. And that leaves us with the Song of Solomon, which is the Jewish rabbis later, they made a rule that you had to be 30 years old before you could read the book of Song of Solomon because it was too mature in its nature. And you go through this book, and everybody has at some point. Some of the language is that kind, as I said Sunday night, it makes us a little uncomfortable. And so what a lot of people do, it must be an allegory. The Jewish rabbis said that the Song of Solomon is about God's love for Israel. A lot of Christian writers said it's about Christ's love for the church. Christ is the groom and the church is the bride. I mean, we sing Jesus Rose of Sharon. Where do you think that language comes from? Or he's the lily of the valley. Which, by the way, just as a little aside, besides the fact that they are taken from Song of Solomon, I think incorrectly, in the Song of Solomon, who is the Rose of Sharon? It's not the groom, you know, is it? The lily of the valley is the woman. That would be the church, not him. But we sing a song, his banner over us is love. I'm not saying that we cannot use those songs. I'm just saying the author, his original intent, he was trying to allegorize it, but I don't see anything to do that. Then there are those who believe that it's Solomon, and there's a competition between him and a shepherd for the love of the Shulamite. That's a very popular view. I've come to believe the more likely, the more natural reading of the book is just to see this is about Solomon and his bride. That part of the book deals with their courtship, part of it their marriage. It's not a straight through from beginning to end, you know, one day follows another day. But it's a collection of poems and discourses about love. And think about love. I mean, excuse me, think about marriage. What's love got to do with marriage? You know, now what marriage in biblical times too often was a negotiated contract between two men. Sometimes the fathers negotiated it. Sometimes the groom, he went to the father and, you know, they discussed how many cows it would take, how many sheep, you know, in the case of Jacob, how many years of work. You know, a young lady might be married off to a man simply because he made the father an offer he couldn't refuse. You know, the book of Song of Solomon, I've come to believe, is a book about marriage as it ought to be, as it was intended from the beginning. A beautiful thing. It is love. You go through this book, there is tenderness, there is passion, you know, there is physical attraction, there's an emotional bond. It is all of that. You know, it's not just the descriptions of the physical that are what make people uncomfortable sometimes, but it's not just the emotion, it's all of it. It's physical, emotional. There's a drawn together here of two people who love each other. And I think that's the message of the book, that this is how you ought to love one another. You read this book and you see her longing for him, him longing for her. The passion they feel toward each other, the attraction, the way that, and I know, I mean, you talk about some odd descriptions, you know, her hair's like a flock of goats and all. I mean, to us, some of the descriptions they use of each other are weird. I mean, you know, I mean, they're the kind that they're not going to win you any points today. But what it shows is two people who complimented each other with the compliments of that day, who spoke well of each other, that didn't disparage marriage and dismiss it as, well, you know, God hates divorce, so I guess we'll try to stay together. No. They actually loved each other in a very special way. And that's what marriage was intended to be. Along the way, it gotten lost. And of all the people to tell us what marriage ought to be like, is not Solomon the most unlikely of candidates? You know, this man knew nothing about personally, you know, at least later on, the true bond between one man and one woman. But God in his wisdom showed Solomon. And I wonder sometimes if Solomon, as he grew older, wondered, why didn't I listen to myself? You know, he didn't listen to his father. He didn't listen to God. And the reality is, when you read Proverbs and Song of Solomon, he didn't listen to himself. Of course, is he that different from you and me? Do we not find ourselves sometimes doing things that we've told ourselves we're not going to do? That we've lectured our children not to do? You know, that as we look at Solomon, learn from his mistakes, but don't think yourself exempt from them. I mean, we don't have to make those mistakes. We can't make them on the grand scale he did. You know, we can't have 700 wives and 300 concubines and 1,400 chariots and all of, but we can get caught up in the things of this world and be led away from God just like he was. All right, Sunday, let's go into the study of the temple, and we are going to, well, we will not get all of chapters 5 through 7, but we'll do what we can, folks.